Welcome to Anchorage Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Anchorage Edition is Michael Carey.
Thank you for joining us. Our guests are Paul Jenkins of the Anchorage Daily Planet, Jill Burke of the Alaska Dispatch, and joining us from Washington, D.C. by Skype, Libby Casey of Alaska Public Radio. Paul, the legislature is in its final days. Last weekend of the legislature, where are we?
I don't know. I'm not sure they know. During this week, of course, the big fight was we went to the Senate to have the Senate defend its position on ACES, Alaska's Clear Equitable Share Oil Tax. Senator Stevens, Gary Stevens, president of the Senate, vowed us how he wouldn't be bullied into making a $2 billion mistake on oil taxes, that chances are that the tax wasn't going anywhere this year, and thereby irritating, I guess, Parnell and the oil industry and probably the House. But then they started talking about the capital budget. The capital budget at this point is, I don't know what the number is.
It started as
2.8 when Parnell wanted to do it, the governor wanted to do it. Jumped up to over 2.9, now it's over 3, I'm told. And some of the increases are frankly fantastic. And the House is angry about that because they're accusing the Senate of packing the bill so that they can't get their goodies in there too. It's already too fat, how are we gonna get our stuff in there?
And this is all in the context of the 50 states, most of the other states are raising taxes in the red, laying
right.
people off.
We're spending money at double hand over foot, okay. Yep, that's right. And they basically haven't, the Senate's made it worse, I think, by not forwarding that bill to the House. The House has no idea what it's going to do. 90-day deadline's up Sunday. The House is promising, the House Speaker is promising, well, we'll just stay longer. You know, the 90 days is in statute, 120 days is in the Constitution. We'll stay longer if we have to. We're not going to pass the bill without hearings and finding out all the stuff about it. So it's a mess as usual in the last few days of the legislature.
Paul, if I might, I want to take a moment. I listened to the audio of Senator President Gary Stevens' speech, and the headline that was in the paper talking about the senators won't be bullied, certainly that's one of the things he said, but I was really quite surprised at how mild his tone was. It wasn't exactly one of regret, but he went through what he considered the facts of why they need to take their time and be prudent, and he knows how concerned Alaskans from all walks of life are, but he wanted to be prudent. It wasn't unusual for the Senate president, it's not unprecedented for the Senate president to step down and make a speech. But he really, I think, went out of his way rather to explain himself rather than to express his emotions.
Well, and he also, I mean, he dwelled on that. He talked about we need more information to make good decisions and they're not going to make bad decisions in haste. And he did spend a good deal of time in that impromptu speech for that.
I think the other thing is that this became an issue about the Senate and what the Parnell administration was saying about the Senate as a whole and reflected, you know, the senators felt badly on their internal politics, and so it got them, you know, circling the wagons and defending themselves rather than discussing ACES.
I think when Governor Parnell called it a do-nothing Senate, I think that helped coalesce everybody in the Senate.
Right, didn't help. Okay, Jill, you have a story that maybe a surprise to some of our viewers. Two of the men who pled guilty in the Polar Penn investigations, the corruption cases, were at the center of it, Bill Allen and Rick Smith. It looks like, perhaps to some people's surprise, they're going to get out of prison a little early.
Right, and this is maybe surprising from the outside, but in the federal penitentiary system, they're just kind of right on track for what's normal. This is Bill Allen and Rick Smith, who were the government's key witnesses in many of the cases. Both worked for VECO, Allen's company, the oil services company that was involved in lobbying the legislature really hard to try to influence these guys. So anyway, they end up in prison. They have respective sentences, I think, of about 21 months and 3 years each. And Rick Smith is actually already out in a halfway house in the Seattle area, and he is due to be released and free of his obligations, I believe, in July of this year, several months early.
That would mean he could come back to Anchorage if that's what he wanted to do.
He could come back to Anchorage if he wanted to do that. Bill Allen is also at this point eligible for early release into a halfway house because he's less than a year away from his release time, and he's due for release in the fall, and again, several months early. Most of that, according to the Bureau of Prisons, is due to two factors. In Rick Smith's case, it's just good time, which prisoners are awarded up front. So you get about 47 days off your sentence per year, and as long as you mind your P's and Q's, you have shaved that amount of time off of your sentence. In Alan's case, he is also eligible for a drug and alcohol treatment reduction. So that implies that he's probably gone through some type of drug and alcohol treatment while incarcerated, and that can take off a third or about a year off of your sentence.
Do you know if there's been any consideration in Alan's case about his medical conditions?
I don't. All I know is that the facility that he's located at, Terminal Island in California, I believe was chosen in consideration of his health issues because they're capable of caring for them.
And he'd definitely be one of the older inmates at this point. I believe he's 73.
You're taxing my memory on that one, but yeah, early 70s. But I think that if I recall correctly, he could have pulled about a third off of his sentence and do about 2 years instead of three, maybe just under.
Let's get Libby Casey in here from Washington. Libby, the government shutdown that wasn't, but there certainly was a lot of commotion in Washington and a lot of upheaval as the shutdown that didn't happen approached.
That's right. It sure came down to the wire. And I'll tell you, D.C. was one stressed out place because there are so many federal workers here. It's interesting because even in the last hours of negotiation last Friday, the Democrats and Republicans couldn't even agree on what they were disagreeing about. The Republicans said Democrats wouldn't agree on a spending number. The Democrats said the GOP was getting hung up on riders. Things like, and this was a big one, not wanting to fund Planned Parenthood, not wanting to give them federal money. The Alaska delegation was pretty united in saying we need to just get this passed, the budget for this year, because there are way bigger battles looming. We got to figure out the budget in the future. We've got to deal with a debt ceiling vote coming up in the next couple of weeks. And Senator Mark Begich warned that a shutdown could have a huge effect in Alaska, 17,000 federal workers, and he was warning that there are over $200 million in military construction projects ready to go that could have been on hold because of that. So they were all happy to get it behind them. Senator Murkowski was one of the few Republicans who was saying, you know, we should not hold this whole thing up over the Planned Parenthood issue. It did get done. The deal got brokered, and it actually passed both the House and Senate yesterday, so it's done now. We won't, we'll have the budget now funded until October when the new year comes up. We can talk a little bit more about what it actually means for Alaska, the bottom line number.
Yeah, let's get to that in a couple minutes, but I wanted to ask you, Libby, there was a vote on the Planned Parenthood legislation, right? And tell us how Senator Murkowski voted.
Yeah, that was ended up being a standalone vote, and Senator Murkowski was one of only five Republicans who voted with Democrats and said, "Don't take the federal money away from Planned Parenthood." So she you know, pretty much walked the walk on that one, and she hasn't really gotten any attention for it. She got some attention early on from the media, but the Republicans seem to have left her alone over that choice. One other thing, Michael, you know, as the delegation has warned, other budget votes are coming up. We saw a big one today in the House. The House Republicans went ahead and supported, all of them except for four, supported a plan by Paul Ryan, who's the congressman who's from Wisconsin, who's the head of the Budget Committee. He has this plan that would cut $6 trillion over the next decade. Obama does not like it. But a lot of Republicans said we got to start the conversation somewhere. So we saw that vote today.
Okay. Thank you, Libby. We'll go now back to Jill Burke. Jill, continuing with the corruption cases, the Bruce Weirach case, and something of a surprise here, there's a possibility that there might be more disciplining of lawyers. And many people thought that might be Bruce Weirach. But now there's a possibility it would be the prosecutors. Tell us about that.
Right. Weirach, who ended his case by pleading to a state court misdemeanor, which eliminated the federal charges he was facing of bribery and conspiracy, and I think money laundering or wire fraud, is not going quietly. He, shortly after taking that plea, he filed with the federal court for permission to be allowed to forward what would otherwise be protected information about evidence they were aware of in the case to the Alaska Bar Association, because Weirach and his attorney, Doug Pope, both believe that federal prosecutors in this case, who happen to be the same federal prosecutors who were on the Ted Stevens trial, committed misconduct before the grand jury, and also, after repeated requests, failed to give them evidence that they knew would help their case. And the judge said, okay, I am going to grant your motion. I believe that this this is merited. Go ahead and forward that information on to the Alaska Bar Association. That's significant because the Alaska Bar Association investigates the conduct of its own attorneys and has the authority to take sanctions if it believes, if it makes findings that this indeed took place. And that could be anything from a warning to losing your law license.
And it'd be pretty unusual to investigate prosecutors. I mean, there have been a number of lawyers who investigated for various forms of misconduct, people who passed the bar and are not practicing law.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, it's just widely assumed that prosecutors lose cases, and it's known, and maybe mistakes were made. But to go the full route of perhaps investigating their behavior in this context, maybe it's only the unusualness of what's happened here.
Well, I think everything about these corruption cases has been unusual. We did ask the Bar Association if they had recalled ever another situation where a prosecutor had been, a grievance had been filed against a prosecutor, and they had only one other case, and it was years ago, and it had nothing to do with, like, the corruption type investigations we've seen here. I also want to add real quick, second development in YREC happened just yesterday where he has asked for his money back. He believes that he can prove that the prosecutor's case was either in bad faith or frivolous, and that the government should pay for his attorney's fees and his litigation costs, which could top nearly $600,000, I believe, $400,000 in staff time for the attorney, another $100,000 or so for a paralegal, plus some incidental expenses. It adds up quickly. They're going to try. We'll see.
It's very interesting because that would raise the possibility that if Vic Coring and Pete Cotter not tried again, they would do the same thing. I mean, it would seem to be natural.
Potentially.
Yeah. Okay. Let's get back to Libby. Okay, Libby, we now have a federal budget for the rest of this year, and there's not much left of the year.
Right.
What's in that federal budget, and what does it mean for Alaska?
So as I was saying, it's about $38 billion in cuts, but it's not as eviscerating as it sounds at first, because some of those things are money like this, for example, in the Commerce Department, that gets a big whack, but a lot of that is money that was not spent on the census. It's left over, so it gets fed back into the budget. An independent report this week showed that the immediate effect of this budget on government would actually be minimal because it's happening over time or it's dealing with standing accounts. But there are real cuts. For example, $600 million for community health centers. Senator Mark Begich lamented money being taken out of the COPS program, which he used as a mayor in Anchorage that affects urban areas. There's also $1 billion in cuts to grants for clean water. As far as Alaska, the biggest hit is to the Denali Commission. The commission got funded at about $10.7 million. That's about a 10% reduction. But the big thing is $15 million in carryover funds that the commission had, the federal government wants it back. It's already been obligated in projects, but it has to go back. So the question is, how will this work? Will they have to pay it back in one lump sum? Can they make payments? And what projects are going to be affected? Our newsroom at APRN has been calling the Denali Commission to try to trace the money. Where is this going to go? And at first they said they couldn't talk about it because they wanted to wait till the votes are done. But it's been 24 hours now, and we still haven't heard back from them about what this actually means. So we need to do some pulling of threads to see the impact. Another cut is to the LIHEAP program, which is low energy help for folks paying for the high cost, low income energy. And that's not going to hit Alaska big, but a lot of people are saying this is a kind of a bellwether or a sign of what may be coming down the pike in next year's budget.
And if I might, on behalf of the viewers here, if there are people out there who want to write a letter or a nasty gram to Congress saying you made a big mistake, Alaska's being treated wrong, who do they write to? Who bears the ultimate responsibility for this?
Well, the delegation all voted for that, for this compromise, as did many of their colleagues. President Obama has recommended cuts to things like the Denali Commission and the LIHEAP program. I think the question is going to be, will there be a pot of money that makes up the difference? There's no Ted Stevens anymore. Can anyone in Congress get a special lump of funds for the Denali Commission? Can the state chip in some money, since we've heard some positive reports
about
the
state funds? Well, I think also, Libby, that what Senator Murkowski, Senator Begich, Congressman Young, the President of the United States all can say is, it would have been so much worse if I hadn't been in there. You know, if I hadn't been in there fighting for you, just think how much worse it would have been.
That's what they say.
Okay, Paul, any thoughts? Any assessment here?
My assessment of this process is ridiculous. It's smoke and mirrors, that sleight of hand of the $38 billion in cuts. We've got the Washington Post says more than 20% of that is rescinded funds, money that wasn't going to be spent anyway, money that didn't exist. It's a paper game.
But if John Boehner was here, wouldn't he say some version of the Republican speaker, listen, you have to start someplace. This is only part of a year. This is what we could do with what we've got.
Well, I think they could start someplace and do better than this if they gave it half a shot, don't you? $38 billion out of a $3 trillion budget? I mean, come on, they can do better than that.
Well, Michael, and that's
why
a lot of Republicans ended up voting against this. You know, Speaker Boehner negotiated this deal, but he had almost 60 members of his own party defect and vote no because, like Paul, they said, there's not enough here. Let's get some real things on the table. So this sets us up for a real political moment here as we go into talking about the next fiscal year, the debt ceiling vote. Because, you know, there are going to be defections on both the far right and the far left. And the question is, how are they going to come up with compromises? I've talked to a couple of pundits down here who said they've never seen the dialogue quite so polarized. We heard the president this week give a budget address so different than what we saw in Paul Ryan's budget the Republicans liked. So it's going to be a very tense and an interesting moment over the next couple months.
And it's clear that the president in particular is trying to say, I'm the reasonable person here. Just trust me, I can be expected to make reasonable decisions that'll be in the benefit of the country, but won't hurt any more people than we have to. And John Boehner is emphasizing, we have to do something about the debt. Does that sum it up?
Yeah, but President Obama this week chastised Republicans. He really called them out. They were a little bit surprised because he'd invited some of them, including Paul Ryan, to his speech at George Washington University. And he said, you know, the cuts they want to do will hurt America's prosperity, will hurt America's future. Republicans say, no, we're going to save America's future because we have to do the belt tightening. So it's not just a money game. It's a politics game. The president has announced his reelection bid, of course. We're going to see a lot of other national politicians on the Republican side step up and throw their two cents in. But the thing that I've heard that's a positive thing from everyone from Don Young to Mark Begich is that this is a real debate, and we're finally talking about the dollars and the cents, the real things. You know, we're not talking about birther issues, where President Obama was born here. Yeah. In Washington, people are talking about the bottom line, and that can be an exciting conversation because it can get things rolling.
Okay, Paul, moving right ahead. Legislators are talking about, speaking of projects, a new legislative office building in Anchorage.
Again.
what's the story? Where would it be? And is this going to happen?
Their digs on 4th Avenue, they say, are too small and the parking is lousy and we don't like it. We want to move. We want new stuff. So they're looking over at 7th Avenue and F Street as a new location for a building. The Legislative Council has given the go-ahead to start negotiating, trying to find a cost and a size for this building. It would be the Anchorage Community Development Authority that would build it and the state would lease it from them, although nobody has any idea what it's going to cost in the long run. This is the third time that I can recall. There was the Unocal building they tried to buy. That was turned down as being too costly, and then they wanted to gut the block across from the state courthouse downtown. And that turned out to be way too costly, so they backed away from that. And here we are at this point. So it remains to be seen.
Okay, let's see what happens. Once again, I'm Michael Carey. I'm here with Paul Jenkins, Jill Burke, and from Washington, D.C., Libby Casey. Libby, Alaska's Commissioner of Natural Resources, Mr. Sullivan, testified before a House committee in Washington, D.C. about offshore oil development in Alaska and the problems that are perceived here involving regulation. What do you have to say, and what was the reception like?
It's a message that you have heard before. He said Alaska wants to be part of America's energy portfolio, but feels hamstrung by the federal government. And we heard that from a couple of Alaskans who were down here. Also, the delegation testified to that effect. What's at issue is whether or not Shell can drill some exploratory wells in the Arctic. And what's holding it up at this point is a clean air permit. And so Shell has said the EPA and this independent board, this environmental appeals board, are hamstringing them. And, you know, it just goes to show what a difference an election makes, because this was in a House hearing. And so Republican run, and Republicans were really on the side of Shell and the state, side of Dan Sullivan, and really hammering away at the couple of environmentalists who were there. An environmentalist from Anchorage, an attorney with Earth Justice, Eric Graffey, was there, and also Rosemary Atungarak, who lives up in Barrow. They both testified their concerns for this legislation, which would essentially kind of fast-track getting drilling permits and such, get rid of some of the clean air regulations. They both said no. I mean, Alaskans need to be able to have an appeals process by which they can voice their concerns about what's happening in their own backyards. Rosemary Atungarak talked about worrying about things that you guys have heard before, hunting for whale and not worrying about oil spills, especially resonating right now as we hit the anniversary of the BP blowout down in the Gulf of Mexico. She also talked about concerns over pollution, but the hearing was a Republican hearing. The EPA didn't show up, and they said they weren't given enough heads up and invited in time, but man, they got blasted. Don Young said, you know, at least you should have sent the janitor, and that probably would have been better than sending anybody else, because he's probably smarter than the rest of them, was kind of his implication. And so it was one of these moments where you see it all play out, the argument at stake, where the legislation will go. It can't move really in the Senate right now with the Democrats ruling there, but it was a chance for a lot of Alaskans.
So a certain amount of it was theater, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And a chance for a lot of Alaskans to come to Washington and make their case. Now, it's really an educational moment, too, because a lot of these committee members, it was in a different committee. It wasn't in natural resources. And so it was new stuff to a lot of them. And so they had a lot of questions about Alaska and what's going on.
And what committee was it in?
It was a subcommittee of energy and commerce. It's energy and power. It's run by a congressman from Kentucky. But we saw some of the big guys come in, the ones who are the top of energy and commerce, like Henry Waxman came in, and he's the Democratic congressman, and he said, from California, he said, this legislation wouldn't just affect Alaska, it would affect places like California, and we don't want to fast-track getting permits. That's why we have a regulation process in place, to have a system of checks and balances.
Okay, thank you very much. Jill Burke, Joe Miller is back in the news, a former Republican stalwart who ran for the United States Senate and defeated Lisa Murkowski in the primary and then lost the write-in. What's he up to?
He is making good on his promise to keep up fighting the good fight for his self-described Tea Party values. This weekend, he is appearing at three Tax Day Tea Party rallies. The first was in Idaho last night, and then he'll appear at two in Kansas over the course of the weekend and on
into
Monday.
Which is his native state.
Yeah, and one of them is his native community of Salina. Salinas. So, and he is, you know, I imagine he'll have a lot to talk about, given that it's the tax weekend, and also we've just seen this budget activity up on the Hill. He also is the newly appointed chairman of a political action committee in Nevada called the Western Representation PAC, which started in 2008 and has gone on to become what they describe as an up-and-coming Tea Party PAC. And one of the comments that Miller has made is that he anticipates that they'll continue to be, the Tea Party will continue to be relevant pushing into the 2012 election cycle. And, it's the familiar talk that we've heard before, that the president is failing, that government spending is out of control, that we remain headed on a course for financial collapse if we don't take some drastic steps.
A lot of outtakes from the campaign.
Right, it is. And that it is voters in which the control for all of this lies, that they have the power to vote out of office the people they feel may be failing on either side, and that it's really about getting back to quote constitutional conservatives. So his profile is elevating again. I think he was quiet there for a little while, mm-hmm. but this weekend,
and
he's
he does
back.
Have money in his campaign coffers remaining from his last election.
He does.
Okay. What's the latest on the self-styled Fairbanks militia people who are now not only in jail but awaiting trial and drop zone?
Okay, the group of militia defendants are kind of on a slow track now. They're all in custody but for one. And the cases have all been declared complex, which slows things down and offers up more time for all parties to kind of do their motion
and they
work.
Have lawyers, and there's a discovery process going
right.
forward.
So they have lawyers. People have been remarking on the staggeringly voluminous amount of evidence in the case, hundreds of hours of audio and videotapes, thousands of pages of documents. The lawyers who need to get their hands on this evidence have said that the prosecutors have said, give us, you know, 2 500 gigabyte disk drives and we'll download the digital media that we have available for you. So that's one reason why it's complex. So those trials are currently scheduled, at least in federal court, for March and February of next year, respectively.
Almost a year.
Regarding Drop Zone,
what is Drop Zone, to remind those who haven't followed it?
Drop Zone is the military supply company that was owned and run by a gentleman by the name of Bill Fulton. Bill Fulton was an associate who kind of traveled in the same circles with this militia group, also happened to be part of a security detail that Joe Miller had hired during his campaign, or this detail
had volunteered,
who arrested my boss, had volunteered to work on the campaign's behalf or on Miller's behalf. So anyway, he was kind of, he's a notable guy. Fulton disappeared immediately after these arrests took place, including signing over ownership of Drop Zone, his Spinard-based military supply company, to a co-worker or a former staffer. That staffer has gone on to change the name. Drop Zone no longer exists, and they are in the process of putting up a new name. I think it's a more generic type of Alaska Army Surplus Supply or something. I don't remember the exact title, but it's continuing. You know, Drop Zone and Drop Zone Bill, as he is known.
They're not even going to put up a sign that says, now under new management.
No, I think he's been open that it's under new management now, but they're all kind of fading.
Okay, thank you, Jill. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Libby, and thank you, Paul, and thank you, viewers, for joining us. We won't be here next week. We'll be back in 2 weeks right here for Anchorage Edition. Bye-bye.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Anchorage Edition at anchorageedition@kakm.org. Or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Anchorage Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.